Okay, every year I find that it's hard to resist the opportunity to explore this period of the calendar year, which actually emerges from this coming week's Parsha, Parshas Emor, and that is the period of Sfirat HaOmer. This happens to be my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, so it has a special place in my heart. Before we begin, of course, I'd like to once again thank the year-long sponsors of our Shiur, Dr. Foyle and Judy Marcus, in memory of their aunts, individuals who I knew very, very well. Okay, so let's take a look. The mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer emerges twice in the Torah. The first time in Parshas Emor, Usfartem lochem mimocharas ha-shabos miyom ha-viyachem es-omer ha-tenufa, Sheva Shabbatot Mimotieno. You shall count for yourselves 7 weeks, 7 Shabbatot, until the time that you bring the waved Omer offering. Then in Parshas, in Sefer Dvarim, Shiva Shavuos Tispor Lecha, Mehen Chol Chormesh Bakama, Tachol Tispor Shiva Shavuot. You shall count 7 weeks from the time that the sickle is first put to the crop, the beginning of the harvest season, you shall count these 7 weeks. So we have this mitzvah of counting days and weeks during this period of time. What the Torah leaves out is why. Why is there a mitzvah? If you think about it, it's sort of something of a strange mitzvah to simply count the days. What's the purpose? And you find that there are a variety of different rationales offered by Chazal, some of them more obvious than others, as to why we should count these days and weeks. The first and most obvious is that we are counting the days between Pesach and Shavuot to connect those two holidays, to create a connection between the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the departure from Egypt, and Matan Torah. Now, if we just take a look for a moment at the structure of the calendar, this creates an interesting phenomenon or an interesting pattern within the Shalosh Regalim. And that is, instead of being Shalosh Regalim, 3 pilgrim festivals, what emerges is that you really have 4 in 2 sets. And each set basically is a multi-day festival followed by a connected yet independent one-day festival. And therefore you have Sukkot leading to Shmini Atzeret and Pesach leading to Shavuot. And Shavuot and Atzeret, Shmini Atzeret, are actually linked many times in Jewish thought. Does anyone know what does the Talmud call the holiday of Shavuot? What's it called in the Mishnah? It's called Atzeret. And in addition to that, there's a famous Medrash that says that Shmini Atzeret should have been as distant from Sukkot as Shavuot is from Pesach. That's the way it was originally intended to be, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu had pity on Bnei Yisrael and didn't want them make them return for yet another pilgrim festival during the winter season, and therefore took Shmini Atzeres and placed it immediately after Sukkot. So you have 2 sets of 2, you have 2 sets of holidays, you have Sukkot leading to Shmini Atzeret and Pesach leading to Shavuot. Now the connection between Sukkot and Shmini Atzeres is for another day. We're going to focus on this connection between Shavuot and Sukkot and Pesach. Why is there a connection between these two festivals? So what would you say? What would the most obvious answer be? The most obvious, yeah, go ahead. Exactly. Pesach is the beginning of the process and Shavuot is the end. What process are we talking about? The birth of the Jewish nation. The creation, the steps that go into the birthing of our nationhood. And you have to connect the physical freedom of Pesach with the spiritual freedom of Shavuot for the birth to be complete. This is seen, in fact, The first time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe at the Sneh, take a look at the bottom of the page. Vayomer Moshe Elohim mi anochi ki eleich el Paro. Moshe is speaking at the Sneh, and he says, who am I to go to Paro? And Hashem's answer is very, very strange. Hashem's answer is, Vayomer ki eye imchoch, I'm going to be with you. Vizel lecho laos ki anochi shlachticho. And if you want to know a real sign that I've sent you to take the Israelites out of Egypt, it's not going to be the parting of the Red Sea. It's not going to be the Makos. It's not going to be your staff turning to a snake. You know what the real sign will be? The real sign will be, Ki anochi emcho, and the os, Ki anochi shlachticho, bohutsiacho esoam mi mitzrayim, tavdu neselokim, al ha-har hazeh. The real sign that I sent you to take the nation out of Egypt and that there is a purpose for that is going to be that you're going to end up here on this mountain, specifically here, Har Sinai, and I'm going to appear to you then. And thus, right from the outset, HaKadosh Baruch Hu ties Matan Torah in with the birth of the Jewish nation and says that the story will be incomplete until you arrive at Sinai. So that's the first and most obvious connection. The first and most obvious connection is that Pesach is incomplete, the story is not finished until you arrive at Har Sinai. In another sense, the story is not finished until 40 years later they enter Eretz Yisrael. But as Rav Soloveitchik says, one of those is the destination and one of those is the destiny. The destiny is Har Sinai, the destination is Eretz Yisrael. Now, if we keep going, turn to the next page. What we find is that the Sefer HaChinuch... Yes?
Haven't you just answered the question?
Correct. So in other words, one of the answers, one of the first, the immediate answer is yes, you are going to be counting. And if you take a look actually down a little bit further on the page, you're counting in anticipation, and we're counting in anticipation and the reliving of that anticipation as well, which is what some of the commentaries will say. The Sefer HaChinuch, one of the Sifrei HaMitzvot, says, Umipneikach ki kol ikron shel Yisrael uva'avura nigalu va'alu l'chol agdula sh'alu alav. It's the whole purpose is to recognize that this is our greatness. Our greatness is not that we got out of Egypt. Our greatness is that we're arriving at Har Sinai. Now, if you take a look, it's interesting. We can actually sharpen this connection by taking a look at another counting that takes place in the calendar over years that is parallel to the counting of Sefirot HaOmer. And what counting am I talking about? What's another counting of 7 times 7 leading to a 50th? Shemitah leading to Yovel, correct. Now, it's interesting. Here, it's tantalizing. You have two countings that are the same structure. Is there a connection between the two? So if you take a look, you find something very interesting. If you take a look at the counting of the Yovel, what does it say? It says, Visofarto lecho, similar to the language by the Omer, which is Usfartem lochem, Sheva shonim, Sheva shonim, Sheva shonim, Sheva shonim, Sheva yomim, and then skip to the last sentence, Ukrosem dror ba'aretz lechol yosheha. And what is going to be the sign of that 50th year? What the sign will be is that you will proclaim, to use a quote that many Americans know, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. All right, now I've mentioned before that I asked in my Yeshiva University class, I asked the class where that sentence is inscribed, and the only person who knew was a Canadian. The Americans didn't know, strangely enough. It's inscribed on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land. Now, we've spoken before about the difference between dror and chirus in Jewish thought. There are two kinds of freedom. Dror is liberty. Liberty is granted to you by someone else. You are achieve liberty when the society removes the shackles that are constraining you. You shall proclaim liberty, right? Chirut is personal freedom. Chirut is something that you achieve for yourself. The Yovel count is usfartem lochem ukrosem dror. That's in the plural. Why? Because the rabbis say that's not an individual counting by each person. Bezdin does that count. Bezdin does the count 7 years, 7 years until you get to Yovel. Why is that the case? Because Bezdin is representing the society, I believe, and therefore it's the society that grants dror. It's the society that grants that element, that liberty. When it comes to Omer, it's usfartem lochem, right? You have to count. What did I say? I'm sorry, I'm going to say it again. I'm tired today. By Yovel, it's not in the plural, it's in the singular. Visofarto lecho sheva shabsos shanim. And visofarto lecho in the singular refers to Bezdin. When it comes to the Omer, it's usfartem lochem. Each of you has to count. Now, what do we believe about Cherus? What do we believe about personal freedom? Ein lecho ben chorin, finish the sentence. Elamisha osek batorah. Only someone, the only person who is truly free in life is someone who follows the Torah, because that frees you to find meaning and significance in life, and no one can do that for you. You have to do that for yourself. So the Omer has to be counted by each individual individually. The Yovel can be counted, or is counted, by Bezdin. And here then you have two parallel countings leading to two similar ends. When it comes to Yovel, you are counting towards societal liberty. When it comes towards the Omer count, you're counting towards the personal freedom that we each achieve by living a Torah true life. Now, the idea that we're counting towards Shavuot is therefore the most obvious connection and the most obvious reason for the counting of the Omer. But there are a set of commentaries who believe exactly the opposite, that the Omer is not a counting towards, it's a counting from. What I'm doing when I count the Omer is I'm leaving Egypt. And leaving Egypt, something we've spoken about very often, was not an easy thing. Leaving Egypt means that you have to transform yourselves. There's, of course, this famous tradition within the Medrash that by the time we reached the Exodus, we had reached the 49th of 50 levels of Tumah. And that God has to, what's the motto that's constantly repeated when it comes to Yitziat Mitzrayim? Chipazon. God has to take us out immediately. You have to leave now. Why? Because if we would have waited a little bit longer, we would have been irredeemable. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, by counting the Omer, I want you to count from Egypt. I want you to recognize, and this is something else we can think about when we're counting the Omer. One is we're counting towards all these reasons, by the way. Whenever we offer multiple reasons, one doesn't negate the other. They're all different layers in the understanding of the mitzvah. So on the one hand, we're counting towards Matan Torah, but we're also trying to take ourselves away from that in the world which would hold us back. We're doing tshuva. We're trying to figure out what is it about our lives that might be impediments to our ability to truly be free, to truly reach the level that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. The Aruch Chaim says something very interesting. It's at the bottom of page 2, and translation is on the next page. The Aruch Chaim says that this counting away from Mitzrayim is like the counting of a nidah, of someone who's moving from the state of nidut to the state of tahara. And you're counting 7 days. Here you're counting 7 weeks. And says the Aruch Chaim, that's why we don't start the count. This is very interesting. It's very sharp. Why we don't count, we start the count on the first day of Pesach. Because you've got to have a full day of tahara to start the count. And therefore, the first day of Pesach, we're still in Mitzrayim for part of the day. So says the Aruch Chaim, you can't count day one. You got to start counting on day two. It's a very, very powerful, it's a very sharp thought. The idea of counting away from Mitzrayim is also underscored by a pasuk that's found at the end of Sefer Bamidbar in Parshas Maaseh. In Parshas Maaseh, this is after the 40 years in the desert. The summary of those travels is introduced by the sentence, Eileh Maaseh b'nei Yisrael asher yotzu me'eretz Mitzrayim l'sivosam. These are the journeys. As I say this, I'm dating myself. I think of Star Trek. These are the voyages, Lahavdil, Elef Avdalos. All right? These are the journeys of Klal Yisrael, Asher Yatsu Me'eretz Mitzrayim Litzivotam. These are the journeys of Bnei Yisrael who left Eretz Mitzrayim in their numbers, in their legions. Says the Malbim, wait a minute, when you talk about a journey, you usually talk about the destination, not the point of departure. Why doesn't it say, Eileh Maaseh b'nei Yisrael b'darakom le'eretz Yisrael? Why does it say, Eileh Maaseh b'nei Yisrael asher yotzu me'eretz Mitzrayim l'sivosam? So says the Malbim. The 40 years, what began as a 49-day trip to Har Sinai and then a quick trip to Eretz Yisrael, becomes through the sin of the spies a 40-year journey in the desert. What was the purpose of that 40-year journey in the desert, says the Malbim? The primary purpose was not to get somewhere. The primary purpose was to leave somewhere, was to get out of Egypt, was to take the Egypt out of Bnei Yisrael, was to transform them into a conquering nation, into a people that could make a difference. And therefore, says the Malbim, you see this concept of counting away from. All right, now, in addition, so we now have two approaches. We have those commentaries who say that the reason we're counting the Omer is to count towards and to connect the two holidays. There are those who say the reason we're counting the Omer is to count away from. There is yet a third approach. And the third approach says it has to do with the time of the year and the markers of this count. The markers of this count, the count begins at the beginning of harvest. And it concludes at the beginning of the wheat, at the barley harvest, it concludes at the beginning of the wheat harvest. You are at a point when the farmer is beginning to turn his mind totally towards earthly concerns. And therefore, says the Maharal, it's dafke at this point that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to count the days towards Har Sinai to connect heaven and earth. In Kemach, in Torah. That you've got to connect the physical with the earthly. And we've spoken about the fact in the past that that is really the summary of man's role. Man's role is to connect, or is to bring Kedusha into the physical world, to bring God's presence into this world through the performance of mitzvot. So therefore you have between heaven and earth this concept of earth, your interest, your concern being earthbound, being wrenched upwards as well, so that you can see, you can look towards Sinai as you're doing this harvest. The Abudram sees this in a very, very practical way. The Abudram says you're going to become so concerned with the harvest, you might forget to prepare for your Aliyah L'Regel on Shavuot. So count these days to remind you that you got to go back to Yerushalayim at their end. So he sees the counting in a very, very specific way. The Sfarno, then he gives another answer, the Abudram. He says the second reason is that these days are days of tsar. What does he mean, days of tsar? Not so much pain, but these are vulnerable days. These are days when the whole harvest is going to depend on these days. It's going to, what you're going to have to eat, what's going to be, this is a time of vulnerability. At this point in world history, you know, I think that this is an amazing thought, because they keep talking now about the fact that the harvest that we will enjoy throughout the world is endangered now by the horrific acts taking place in the Ukraine. That's going to have an effect on the wheat that goes, because so much of the wheat that we consume throughout the world comes from both Russia and the Ukraine. So we who live, you know, in cities and don't often think about the Well, here in Israel, we think a lot more about it. I'm thinking when I was back in the States, no one ever really thought much about things like harvest and things like that. That's why living in Israel is so much more real, because you sense the changing of the seasons and you recognize this. Nonetheless, this is a, and therefore says the Abu Dram, this is a time of tsar, and the Omer is reminding you to pray that this period should be a rich period, that this period should be a good period, that it should start things off in the right way. The Sfarno goes a step further. The Sfarno at the bottom of the page says that all the chagim are prayers, in a sense, for different parts of the harvest cycle. And he says the Sfira is a reminder to pray not only at particular moments, but at every day. That every day we should pray for Parnassa. That every day we should remember how, and you're counting the days in this harvest season to remind you what he says of the prayers Yom Yomiyim. Pardon me, hold on one second. I thought I showed off my phone. Little discombobulated, not only because I'm tired, but because I'm not wearing my regular glasses. They're in repair. So when you don't see things that clearly, you don't, everything's a little off kilter. There are, if you turn the page, okay, so we have now three global approaches to Sfirat HaOmer. You're counting towards, you're counting from, you're counting to connect heaven and earth. There are a variety of additional messages that emerge from the act of Sfirat HaOmer. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal draws a difference between two kinds of counting in Jewish thought. He says you can count in the realm of minyan, you can count in the realm of limnot, minyan, or you can count in the realm of sfira, lispor. Minyan, he says, is a count where all that really matters is the goal, the ultimate place you get. You can have nine wonderful men, but if you don't have a tenth, you don't have a minyan. When it comes to Sfira, he says, it's different. You're counting, but each individual unit is itself a goal. Each individual unit, it's like someone counting precious diamonds. And he wants to know how many he has, but he's taking each diamond and at the same time holding it up to the sun, the rays of the sun, to see its unique facets. Each day is important, says the Rav. Each day. So often we're focused only on the goals, and the goals are important, that the journey disappears. And it's so much the richness of the journey that is so much of Gesundheit, that is so much of life, and that actually ultimately ends by giving the goal even more significance. To Sfira is a reminder, count the journey, count the days, not just where you want to go, but that each passing day is beautiful. I've often said that, you know, when you think back and you talk to your children about the things you remember and the things they remember, very often the things that you thought were most important, a trip here, something there, that's important to them, but what was more important was a day when you took the time to play ball with them, or a day when it was a snow day, and that particular, days that you didn't think were that important, moments that you thought were okay, but not necessarily that impactful, that became the most impactful for them. The idea of the journey underscored. Another message that emerges from Sfira is the journey from grain to bread. There, the Omer sacrifice that launches Sfira, that launches the count, is a grain sacrifice. We're offering the grain. When we get to Shavuot, the offering is Shtei Halechem. The offering is two loaves. You're taking the grain and you're turning it into bread. This reminds us of a very beautiful story that's told in the Talmud, where Rabbi Akiva is challenged by a Roman who says, if God wanted you to be circumcised, why didn't he create you that way? Why did he create you imperfect if this is what he wanted? And the answer is, so Rabbi Akiva comes to the Roman the next day and brings him grain and bread and says, which of these two is better, the grain or the bread? And he says, well, of course, the bread. He says, well, that's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to partner with him in the creation of the bread. And that's why Hashem has us do a bris milah. He wants us to partner with him in the completion of that child. And therefore, you have this concept of our role in this world to partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to complete the world. You also have a very important set of halachot that emerge from the period of Sfira that often aren't recognized as emerging from this moment. The Omer sacrifice is what we call a matir. Halachically, a matir is something that allows you to do something. What is allowed by the Omer sacrifice? The consumption of this year's wheat. That's the difference between chadash and yashan. What does it mean when they say this bread is chadash flour or this bread is yashan? Chadash is the new crop. Yashan is the old crop. Until I get to the first to the second day of Pesach, I'm not supposed to eat the new crop until I've offered it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in our day, when the offer isn't present, the time moment is present. And that's why you have this concept that, and certainly in the land of Israel, and according to many, even outside, and it's a debate, but becoming more observed even outside, that people will only, up until the time of the second day of Pesach, eat that which is produced from last year's grain until we get to the point where now we can start eating this year's grain. And that's the point that launches Sfira to Omer. Now, all of this are the biblical roots of this period. And therefore, if you were to ask me, this period emerges as a period of anticipation. It's a period of joy. It's a period of excitement. It's a period when we're moving towards something. Along comes history and changes the flavor of the period. And how does the flavor change? And it changes through a historical overlay. And what's that overlay? That overlay is, according to Chazal, and you'll see this, Amru, in the middle of page number 4, Amru Shneimasar Elef Zugim Talmidim Hayu Lo L'Rebbe Akiva. There were 12,000 pairs of students to Rebbe Akiva, and they all died during this period, Mipnei Shelo Nahagu Kavod Zeba Zeh, because they didn't treat each other with proper respect. And again, we should realize that their level, probably what we won't call disrespect, is much deeper or worse than what they, but for whatever reason, they were lacking in the level of respect that could be expected from them. Now, an interesting question though, I mean, this is a terrible tragedy, but there are other tragedies in Jewish history that didn't create this same kind of overlay. I mean, you have the Crusades, you have the struggle with the Yom HaShoah, you have all that. Why did this particular tragedy warrant the creation of the mourning that occurs during Sfira to Omer? So you see, the Gemara actually gives you that answer. The Gemara says, in the second line, after it says, Shelo Nahagu Kavod Zeh LaZeh, V'Haya HaOlam Shamem, the world was desolate, Ad Sheba Rabbi Akiva Eitzel Rabbo Senu Sheba Darom, until Rabbi Akiva came to the rabbis in the south, Vishonolahem Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yosef, and Shamua, Vehemem Yidu Torah. What happened? What happened was that with the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, there was a potential break in the halachic process. This was a very, very sensitive time. This is just when, after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, halacha is rising to the fore with the destruction of the Second Temple, and it's the halachic process that's going to what? It's going to maintain Jewish identity across the ages. And a break in the halachic process at this point is potentially devastating. And therefore, the Gemara says, Hoya ha'olam shamem. When these students died, there was this break. There was no one learning Torah until Rabbi Akiva went to the south, found new students, a handful of new students, began to teach them, and that maintained the continuity of the halachic process. So when we mourn during this period, we're not only mourning the terrible death of these students, which itself is a tragedy, but we're also mourning the potential rift that it caused in the halachic process, which now allows us to see that it's not a coincidence that we are observing this mourning during this period. Because if it's a mourning over the potential rift in the halachic process in Torah, we are now moving towards the receiving of the Torah. So therefore, it's not a coincidence that they died during this period, and it's not a coincidence that we are mourning during this period. It also underscores Rabbi Akiva's very, very important teaching. We're going to talk about this at the end. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, ze klal gadol ba'Torah, their lack of fulfilling that teaching causes this rift. Now we're going to move into something very, very different, and that is that, before we do that, obviously, when we talk about the mourning of Sfirat HaOmer, there are various different minhagim that have developed as to what days within Sfira you're actually mourning. Some mourn from Pesach until Lag BaOmer, some mourn from Pesach through the day of Lag BaOmer, some mourn from Rosh Chodesh through Lag BaOmer until the days before Shavuot. This all develops out of a debate within Chazal as to the historical facts here. When did the death of Rabbi Akiva's students actually occur? Everyone agrees that it occurred for about a 33-day period, but the question is when. Some say it occurred ad pros ha'atzeres, that it occurred until the halfway mark in the 30-day period of preparation for Shavuot, which takes you about to the point of Lag BaOmer. Others say that they died throughout the period, but they didn't die on any of the days when you didn't say Tachanun. They were spared on those days. So you have various different interpretations. And what's interesting is that unlike most minhagim, where you have to keep the minhag that you received from your fathers and you can't change, it's potentially possible to switch minhagim from year to year, in this case, according to some, because you're not arguing about the number, you're just arguing about how to fit it into Sfira. And we're also lenient, by the way, if you're invited to a simcha from someone who is observing a different minhag, and it falls during your Omer Avelus, but not theirs, you're allowed to attend. And all this has to do with the differences of the minhagim and where they emerge from. Now, what's fascinating about Sfirat HaOmer is that it also can serve, if you look at it a particular way, as what I call a halachic laboratory. There are a series of issues raised concerning the Sfira, it's a very discrete mitzvah, that strike to the core of fundamentals of halachic process. And it serves as a good example, a good exercise to take a look at how we apply those fundamentals to this particular mitzvah. Let's begin with asking a question. Today, is Sfirat HaOmer midoraita or midrabanan? Today, is the counting of the Omer a biblical mitzvah or a rabbinic mitzvah? Now, you may ask, wait a minute, well, hold on a second. We started the shiur quoting biblical text that said Sfirat HaOmer is a biblical mitzvah. So what's the issue? So there is an issue. What's the question? We say in the text, Usfartem lachem, miyom haviachem et omer hatenufa, from the time that you bring the omer sacrifice. So the question is that the connection drawn to establish cause and effect or just to establish a calendar date? Is the Torah saying that the bringing of the omer is the trigger that causes you to count, which would mean that in the absence of that Omer sacrifice, there would be no biblical mitzvah to count, and the only reason you're counting is because the rabbis are establishing a mitzvah zecher lemikdash, as a remember of the Beis HaMikdash? Or is the Torah saying, no, when you bring the Omer, that's when you count, and when the Omer's not brought, that's when you count as well. It's just we're establishing the date, the period, when the count begins. As you would expect, this creates a machlokas. This creates a rabbinic difference of opinion. What's interesting, though, is there are not only, in this case, there are not only two positions, there are actually three positions. All right. On the one hand, you have the Rambam and those who agree with him, who hold that the Sfira today is a biblical mitzvah. It remains a biblical mitzvah, according to the Rambam, because the Torah doesn't hinge the counting on the bringing of the sacrifice, but also allows you, tells you to count from the, that's the date when you're supposed to start. The Ramban and those who follow Nachmanides and those who are in his camp say no. And this is the predominant position. The counting of Sfirat Omer today is a rabbinic counting, which is why after you count, you say a harachamon. Harachamon yachzir lanu, right? The avodas beis hamikdash, return the beis hamikdash. Why? Because what you're stating is, I'm counting in remembrance of the temple. I'm counting according, perhaps according to those who are saying that it's a rabbinic mitzvah. And then there's a third position, position of Rabbeinu Yerucham, who holds that the counting of the days and the weeks are separate mitzvot, and one of them is biblical and one of them is rabbinic. Right, now, these are so you have these three. Now, you may say, well, what's the fuss about? Whether it's biblical or rabbinic, doesn't matter, right? I have to do it. So why is it important to know? Well, it's important to know what you're doing it for, but it's also important to know because it has halakhic ramifications, particularly in the area of safek, in the area of uncertainty. If you enter into an area of uncertainty, there are two rules, two connected rules. Safek deoraita lechumra, safek derabanan lekula. That a biblical safek, have to be stringent in your decision about. A rabbinic mitzvah, you should be lenient about. You can lean towards leniency, pardon the pun. Now, what's happening here? How do I ever have safek in Sfirat Omer? Well, in a number of ways. Let's start with the structure of the day. There is a period of our day, every day, which is an uncertain period. And that period is the period between sunset and nightfall. Bein hashmashot, literally. The period between the suns. What is uncertain about that period? We don't know where it belongs. The Jewish day starts at night. When does night begin? Does night begin at sunset? Or does night begin at nightfall? And you have a series of opinions as to what that period is. What's sunset, what's nightfall? But let's just keep those terms the way they are. Now, you could go through life not paying much attention to this period. Why? Because halacha accounts for it. How does halacha account for it? Easily. You start Shabbos early and you end Shabbos late. I know that. Why? Because you start Shabbos at sunset or beforehand with Hadlakat Neirot, and you end Shabbat with three stars, which is nightfall. Now, why am I doing that? I'm contradicting myself. On Friday, I'm saying that the next day starts at sunset. Why? Because I have the period of Bein Hashmashot before me. It's a period that is what? I'm dealing with a biblical mitzvah. It's a period of uncertainty. So what do I have to say? I have to be stringent. I have to consider that maybe the day starts on Friday. And therefore, since the day starts on Friday, the day starts at sunset on Friday. And therefore, I have to observe Shabbos from sunset on. But then at the end of Shabbos, I have the same problem. I get to sunset on Motzei Shabbos. Once again, I'm confronting a biblical uncertainty. What do I have to do? I have to be strict there too. So I have to add this period on at the beginning of Shabbos and add it on at the end of Shabbos because I have that's dealing with a biblical uncertainty of Safek. And as I said, you could go through life without paying much attention to this unless, like happened to us, your oldest son is born Bein Hashmashos Friday night, all right? And under those conditions, when did my son have his bris? Sunday is correct. Why Sunday? He couldn't have it on Friday because maybe it's a day too early, and a bris a day too early is ineffectual. He couldn't have it on Shabbos because maybe it wasn't supposed to be on Shabbos. And you can only have it on Shabbos when you're certain the bris should be on Shabbos. So here was a case where you had, thank God, a healthy boy who, according to the Mohel, this is an unusual child. He almost doesn't have any jaundice, quote unquote. All right. And could have had the bris on time, but has to have the bris either one day or 2 days later, because you have to wait. And that's dealing with this period of Bein HaShemashot. And we could talk philosophically about why does our tradition allow for this uncertainty? You know, we're so certain with time. You know, Lich mentioned it's 552.34, or you know, why? But perhaps what we're saying is that every day has to have a period of uncertainty because uncertainty is part of life, and maybe it's an important part of life because it's uncertainty that pushes us to achieve. If we knew how everything turned out, we wouldn't push further. We wouldn't reach. So therefore, the idea of uncertainty is built into our very day. Now, how does this apply to the Omer? Well, most often, a shul is davening mincha and then mariv. And most often, the shul is davening mincha before sunset and mariv after sunset, and then counts the Omer. And you are smack dab in the period of Bein HaShemashot. Because even though you're counting that as the next day, you're allowed to daven Maariv during that period, even though you should say the Shema again after nightfall, nonetheless, can you count? According to the Rambam, I can't count now. I have to be strict. I have to wait until nightfall for it to be the next day. According to the Ramban and his position, and those who agree with him, I can count now, Bein HaShemashot, right now. And it's better to count now because everybody will remember to do it. Right? So the rabbi has to make a decision. And in most cases, the rabbi will say we can count now. In most cases, because of the concern that people would forget, and that Rove Poskim say that you can count Bein HaShemashot, that this is a rabbinic mitzvah at this time. But let's go to another kind of suffix. And this is the kind of suffix that we encounter every year. And that is, what if I forget? Or what if I'm not certain? Right? What if I don't know if I counted, right? So under those conditions, this relates to a one word in the Torah. And that word is the word timimot. The Torah says you should count sheva shabbatot timimot. You should count 7 complete weeks. So that word is somewhat superfluous. If the Torah would have said, count 7 weeks, I would know I'm supposed to count 7 complete weeks. Why is it tmimot? And this gives rise to 2 different rabbinic opinions, right? Opinion number one is that each day has to be complete. What do I mean by each day has to be complete? Each day you have to count the night before. If you remember during the next day, then that's not a complete day, right? Because you missed half the day, you missed the night. So what do you do under those conditions? You count, but you count without a bracha. Why do you count without a bracha? Because the bracha is a biblical mitzvah, is a rabbinic mitzvah. All brachot are, except for Birkat HaMazon, and some say Birkat HaTorah, all brachot are rabbinic. If you don't know if you're supposed to say a bracha or not, you don't say it. Because since it's rabbinic, you don't say it. You want to be lenient and you don't want to say Shem Hashem Levatala. So I have to be worried. If I didn't count during the night, I have to be worried. Maybe it's no longer a mitzvah for me to count today because it's not a complete day. I have to worry for that position. And therefore I count, but I count without a bracha. There is a second position that holds that tmimot doesn't mean each day has to be complete. Well, what would the other option be? The whole counting has to be complete. That if I miss an entire day, what? That maybe it's no longer a mitzvah. And this ties into the question of whether the mitzvah is 49 separate mitzvot, or whether it's one long mitzvah. And this is a minority position, even though everybody knows it, we all, and that is that if you miss a day entirely, You continue to count. Everybody says, oh, no, I missed the count. No, you didn't miss the count. According to most positions, you should still count. But you can't say a bracha. Why can't you say a bracha? Because it's possible that you missed the count. It's possible that the whole count has to be complete. It's a suffix. And therefore, I can't say the bracha because I'm not sure. But what about the one halacha that seems not to make that much sense? If I forgot during the night and I counted during the day, I count during the day without a bracha, but what about the next day? I can continue to say a bracha. Why? Right? Why is that so? So every time I try to explain this, it becomes too complicated. You really need a blackboard to explain it. But let me try. Let's say the halacha is that each day has to be complete. All right? So if each day has to be complete, I missed that day because I counted it during the day. But that position does not hold that the whole count has to be complete. Right? So even if I missed that day, I can still, according to that position, count with a bracha. Because the count, that if missing a day doesn't mess me up for the rest of the count. And if conversely, no. The explanation of the word tmimot is you shouldn't miss an entire day. Well, that position doesn't hold. The whole day has to be complete. It's either or. And therefore, when I counted during the day, according to that position, guess what? I caught the day, and now the count's complete. So either way, mimonafshach, to use Gemara language, either way you slice it, I'm still good. I'm still okay with counting with a bracha. Because again, each position has to have one of the two, and you've matched it, and it's okay. There is one last message that emerges from Sfirat HaOmer that I find particularly poignant, and it's a message that emerges from the mystery of two converging facts. And that is, on the one hand, you have 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva perished during this period, shelo nahagu kavod ze bo ze, because they didn't treat each other with respect. On the other hand, who were they students of? Rabbi Akiva. What was Rabbi Akiva's most important principle? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. His most important principle was love for your neighbor as yourself. How is it possible that the students of Rabbi Akiva, it's a tantalizing mystery, that they should perish dafka for that sin, right? The sin which seems to negate their teacher's teaching. Okay, so, yeah?
It's very possible that is the event that caused it.
Oh, good. Okay, so I'm going to give two answers. One answer is exactly that. That's probably the simplest answer. And when I simplest, I don't mean simplest in the negative sense. I mean the most direct. It's a temporal issue. When did Rabbi Akiva realize v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha? Perhaps the catalyst for that teaching was the death of his students. That he looked at his students and he said, where did they fail? And were so sorely punished for it. The essence of the Torah is this, and that's why it happened. There's another possibility. And the other possibility, it's a little more far-fetched, but it teaches us a very important lesson, so I think it's worthwhile to think about. The other possibility is that Rabbi Akiva felt this principle was so self-evident that he didn't have to teach it to his students. That it was so fundamental to his faith system that he says, you know, that you know. I don't have to teach you that. And he started beyond it. And it was afterwards that he realized that, no, you can't ever take for granted that your children or your students are going to feel the same way about things as you do, or will start with the same givens that you do. And I think this is a terribly important lesson. If you take a look at the days we're about to celebrate, the day we marked and the day we're about to celebrate, and they fall during the Omer, and I don't think it's a coincidence, these are days that speak to us of events that shaped our gestalt for the negative and for the positive, and shaped our history. Yom HaShoah, and all that devastation. Yom HaTzmaut, Lahavdil Elef Havdalot, Yom HaZikaron and Yom Yerushalayim. And these are days that form the way we view the world, right? With the way our parents view the world and the way we view the world. They are not necessarily days that are going to inform the way our children view the world. They're going to grow up in a world where the concept of a world without the state of Israel isn't something that's real to them. This is, and therefore Israel could be taken for granted, and the blemishes could rise to the fore, as opposed to all the to remember, to see in our mind's eye the people who danced in the streets when the day of when the state of Israel was proclaimed. They're not necessarily, that scene isn't necessarily going to be imprinted on there to understand what Sharansky said during this Ukrainian disaster, where he said, you know, when I left Egypt, well, when I left Russia, he said, nobody wanted to be Jewish, right? You wanted to hide your Jewish identity. He said, today, if you've got a piece of Jewishness, you want to proclaim it because you've got a place to go. You've got a place to go. That changes everything. That changes the world. And our children aren't going to necessarily feel it the way we feel it. Someone said to me, and this was particularly, I don't know if I repeated this to you, he said, before one of our Yom HaShoah programs in Englewood, and now it wasn't exactly right then, but as the years progress, it's almost exact. He said, do you know that a child born today, and the Americans among us will appreciate this, the child born today, he said, will be as distant from the Shoah at his bar mitzvah as we were on our bar mitzvah from the Civil War in America. That the years, now the Civil War in America is ancient history. Ancient history. At least that's the way you feel. So to see that our children will be growing up in a world where for them the Shoah is ancient history, so therefore it becomes so important for us to transmit and to emphasize what we feel are the givens. Even those things that we think are so self-evident that, you know, how can you not see that? They have to be stated, they have to be transmitted, they have to be underscored. And perhaps that's also a message that potentially emerges from this mystery of how it could have happened. That maybe Rabbi Akiva thought it was so self-evident, you don't have to teach it, and the lesson is, yes, you do. So we've covered a lot of ground. These are rich days. They are days that are multifaceted, multi-layered. The messages that emerge from them are multifaceted and multi-layered. And they transcend history. They move from the biblical times to the rabbinic times to modern times to our own times as well, with lessons that shape our lives. Bezras Hashem, let's remember to count, yes, and remember the significance. All right, excellent. You're raising a very good question. When we encounter something like this, let me repeat it for the people who are on Zoom. How do we deal with this historical statement that the 24,000 students died because they failed to treat each other with respect? How do we accept that? Why didn't Rabbi Akiva perish as well? Why did others? There are all sorts of commentaries who wrestle with this. There are those who will take it very literally, that this was a plague. It seemed to be centered around the students of Rabbi Akiva, and the interpretation that was derived from it was that they weren't being respectful to each other enough, and that's the way the Chazal saw it. There are others who actually go far afield and say that the Torah, that the Talmud is speaking in symbols here, and that in reality they perished during the war with the Romans, and it was referred to as a plague. And again, but the traditional explanation, the traditional way that this is viewed, is that when the rabbis saw this tragedy, and apparently limited to that population, apparently it would seem, that they this was the interpretation that arose as to how and why it happened. But that's the best
thing. Like a spiritual thing, because
yeah. Well, they do, unfortunately, but they also, but you can have, you know, I'm thinking now of Legionnaire's disease, for example. You can have some plagues that, that center in certain populations and remain in those populations when, you know, once the plague emerges. So anyway, yeah.
No yes? Question, comment.
Right, correct. So in other words, well said, that the level, that's what I meant when I said that their level of disrespect was you know, not what we would call disrespect, that more was expected of them, which is another lesson, by the way, of leadership, that the higher you rise in leadership, we said this before, the more is that, rather, you know, today in modern society, leaders seem to feel that leadership exempts them from personal responsibility sometimes,
well,
as opposed... for leader
to be
correct
to be a liar, but
I'll right it's not necessarily necessary to be a liar to succeed in politics, but somehow it seems to be a good character trait to be that is needed. But yes, the answer is, according to Jewish law and what should be world thought, is that the higher you rise in leadership, the greater your personal responsibility for the truth and for other all other elements. And this is something that is underscored by their death, that the more was expected of them because of who they were. I'm reminded again of another state. Sharansky is always very sharp. Sharansky says, I'm the only member of Knesset that was in jail before I was in Knesset. All right. So it's sharp. It's sharp. Yes. That's the we believe that miracles and prophecy ended. Evaded our. This is that's an excellent question. I really have to think about it. Let me repeat that for the Zoom, and it ties into your question, which is, you know, we believe that prophecy ends around the time of the return from Babel, right? In other words, that's when the non-prophetic era emerges, and that's why you have Purim emerging at that point, et cetera, et cetera. That means that we can no longer have a lock on our knowledge of why things occur. And that we have to be very careful about saying why things occur. That you can't, if someone gets sick, say to them, oh, it's because they sin. You have no idea why something is happening. So the question is, how could we then say that this was the cause for this? With the certainty that we seem to be saying in this case. And I'll come to think of it, this destruction of the Second Temple, we say, was because of particular sins. The only answer I can give to you off the top of my head is that the rabbis will sometimes say, it seems like this is why it occurred. In other words, we're correlating it. The destruction of the Second Temple was because of sinat chinam, right? It was because of hatred for no reason. How? Well, we'll take a look at the events that surround the destruction of the Second Temple. We see the way we hated each other. We see the way there was no unity. We see the way we were fighting each other. And therefore, we'll attribute the destruction to that horrific sin. There seems to be this same kind of thing here.
It could be.
In other words, there is this idea that in the case of the Second Temple, it's easier to see, because yes, the political divisions among the Jews weakened them in the face of Rome, and therefore, and in some ways, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was begging them to stop these things so that they wouldn't fight Rome, because he saw the impending destruction. This is a little bit harder to see. In other words, the correlation between Shelo nahagu kavod ze bazeh and their death is not as obvious a correlation. Maybe there are pieces of it that we don't know. In other words, maybe there were stories about how they treated each other or how they failed to respect each other properly. We don't know. But there was enough evidence that moved the rabbis to say, you know, that could have been the cause here. But it's a very interesting very interesting problem, and I thank you for raising it, both of you. Okay. All right, everybody. Thank you very much. We'll see you, Bezras Hashem, next week.